Denmark has come to a painful conclusion about its longtime and most powerful ally.
There was a realization among the political elite that the U.S. no longer has our back. Now we need to be able to defend ourselves.
That's why mandatory military service in Denmark has gone from 4 to 11 months. I'm Marco Werman, also today a writer from Cameroon, kicked out of his home country, who does not embrace the label of dissident.
I don't know if I consider myself a dissident. I simply consider myself a person, because it will give too much honor, really, to a tyranny.
We'll also visit the last island prison in the Western Hemisphere, from penal colony to tourist attraction, and we go to Cortina, Italy, to hear about some of the wildest moments so far in the Winter Olympics.
I've seen a lot of firsts here, but this one really blew my mind.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us on this President's Day. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was in Munich over the weekend for the Multinational Security Conference, where he offered what seemed like a message of reassurance to U.S. allies in Europe.
We belong together. America was founded 250 years ago, but the roots began here on this continent.
Rubio got a standing ovation at the end of his speech. Compared to the address by Vice President J.D. Vance at last year's Munich Security Conference, some European leaders felt this one came across as more constructive and less hard-edged. The next two stops on Rubio's European itinerary sent a different message, though. On Sunday, he was in Slovakia, and today the secretary stood next to Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, who's running for a fifth consecutive term in office, and offered him an endorsement.
President Trump is deeply committed to your success because your success is our success.
The far-right governments of Hungary and Slovakia both have well-earned reputations for being skeptical towards the European Union and being friendly with Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Peter Kreko is the head of the Budapest-based think tank Political Capital. He says Rubio's trip sends a message about the Trump administration's priorities.
I think it just fits in the pattern that the United States is increasingly looking for deeper alliances with the countries that cultivate some kind of hostility towards the European Union.
Going into this weekend's sessions in Munich, there was a major disagreement between the U.S. and Europe over the future of Greenland. Despite the U.S., Denmark, and Greenland coming together in a new working group on the matter, Denmark's prime minister said the issue is not resolved. Meantime, the Danish government is strengthening its military, a move partially fueled by uncertainty over the relationship with the U.S. Denmark has decided to extend mandatory military service from 4 to 11 months, and it's no longer allowing women to opt out of serving. It's all part of a European-wide shift as security concerns grow. Croatia brought back mandatory military service in January, for example. Germany has not ruled out compulsory conscription. DW's Terry Schultz went to Denmark to visit the first class of new conscripts, starting to train under their new system.
Haderslev is the southwestern Danish city where this country last fought a war on its own territory. Now the military base here is where Denmark has launched its new conscription program, training troops for a hypothetical war of the future, less unimaginable after Donald Trump's threats to forcibly annex Greenland. Colonel Kenneth Strom is the head of the Danish conscription program.
This is definitely a very big day for the Danish defense. It makes the possibility to have more combat power and have the combat power faster.
Conscripts, both men and women, will serve 11 months, almost triple the period of mandatory military training over the last couple of decades. Until now, Denmark has so many youth eager to serve, it actually has to turn people away. The government made these changes only reluctantly after concluding it needs stronger self-defense, not just because of Russian aggression, but because of the uncertainty of its traditionally strongest ally, the United States. Here's Peter Viggo Jakobsen. He's a military analyst with the Royal Danish Defense College and an advisor to the government.
Denmark was postponing, hoping that it wouldn't be necessary. But then Trump came along in January of last year and started threatening to take Greenland. And then we had a threat assessment from the Danish military intelligence service saying that in the event of a Russian attack, we had to assume that the U.S. would not help us. So basically, there was a realization among the political elite that the U.S. no longer has our back. Now we need to be able to defend ourselves.
19-year-old Leora Olsen is among those volunteering to do that.
I'm happy to be here.
Do you like the idea of staying 11 months instead of 4?
Yes, I think it gives more opportunity to learn more and to have more experience.
But it might also be confusing. Who's the enemy these days anyway? I asked 23-year-old conscript Sebastian Hedegaard as he unpacked his things in the barracks.
What do you think will be the scariest thing that you'll face as a soldier?
I can't really say. Well, it's obviously going to war is a big part, but maybe it won't happen. Maybe it will. We'll take it one day at a time.
Do you think it's closer than it was a year ago?
Yes. A little bit, maybe. Yeah.
Because of the Americans or the Russians?
In the entire world. Just in the state we're in.
Regiment Commander Corey Jakobsen acknowledges he won't be able to avoid discussing the Trump factor in training the new troops entering Haderslev.
The new youth that we're actually getting in, they are on social media, they are on the media all the time, so they actually know what's going around in the world. So we cannot just ignore it and say, now it's 11 months of conscription and nothing is going on in Europe. So we actually have to address that issue and tell them what's actually going on and what are we going to use them for frame as well. So I know that I need to address it. I know that I need to talk to them about it. And I know that some of them are actually quite eager to know what are the Danish defense going to do? What are the government going to do about this?
Military analyst Peter Viggo Jakobsen says there won't be any way of sugarcoating this.
The U.S. no longer have our back the way we used to believe. And it's up to Denmark and Europe to generate the capacity to be able to defend ourselves with minimal U.S. support. That's what we're going to, you know, tell these youngsters. And that's also what I'm telling all the people at secondary education that are just about to do their conscription. That we now have to devote a year to defending Denmark if they want to be able to enjoy the Denmark that they have known throughout their lives.
Even with the Greenland crisis averted for the moment, with negotiations that took place last month between NATO chief Mark Rutte and U.S. President Donald Trump, Denmark plans to continue the buildup of its military. Officials say by the year 2033, there will be almost 2,000 more troops trained per year than there are today. Terry Schultz, Haderslev, Denmark.
Terry's report came to us from our partners at DW, Deutsche Welle, and their Inside Europe podcast. In 2019, the last island prison in the Americas closed its cell doors. The Islas Marias penal colony, located off the west coast of Mexico, opened in 1905. It housed hardened criminals and political prisoners. Authorities closed down the prison following reports of terrible conditions. They hoped the closure would consign the legacy of corruption and political persecution at Islas Marias to history. Then, in 2022, Mexico opened the island for tourists. You can now visit cells once used for solitary confinement, as well as a graveyard and lodge and hotel rooms built where prisoners used to be confined. Reporter Jamie Fullerton joined a tour to learn more.
I walk past a soldier wearing camo fatigues and holding a machine gun, then past a large sniffer owl station. Then I step onto the ferry. I'm travelling in a group largely comprised of middle-aged and elderly Mexican tourists. We're taking the four-hour ferry to Islas Marias, an archipelago located about 100 kilometres off the west coast of Mexico's Nayarit state.
Okay, what made me come is because a long time ago I saw a movie about the island. When I saw that movie a long time ago, I kind of got curious because he was famous, he had a good movies.
Francisco Epinosa is one of the 100 or so tourists with me on the ferry. He tells me that Islas Marias is notorious in Mexico in the same way that Alcatraz is in the US. Islas Marias' fame was bolstered by the 1951 movie Las Islas Marias, directed by Emilio Fernandez. The movie is about a man who kills someone for his family's honour and is sentenced to the notorious penal colony. It was filmed on the islands. The prison island's fame is also down to it being home to some of Mexico's most feared criminals.
it was famous. Yeah. It was very famous because they had a really, really bad criminals.
You can now book an all-inclusive weekend trip on Islas Marias for about $550.
Everybody heard about this particular prison, you know, all of a sudden close it and then put it as a touristic place. It's a big deal. So a lot of Mexicans, we were interested to come and see.
The islands are home to endemic animal species, including rabbits, raccoons and parrots. The area is now a bioreserve and has conservation projects to preserve its ecosystems. But can a place with such dark history thrive as a holiday and nature hotspot? A big hotel complex has been built near a beach on the largest of the six Islas Marias islands. It's where some of the prisoners used to be housed. Today, herds of wild goats canter between white-painted villas and bright green parrots perch overhead in trees. Everyone working on the tours works for the Navy, which runs Islas Marias operations. I join the tourists on a bus, then we're driven over bumpy, dusty roads and past sweeping views of the ocean. We stop near a complex of stark grey buildings surrounded by chain-link fences topped with barbed wire. It used to be the maximum security section of the prison, which opened in 2011, but only operated for a few years. We go inside one of the buildings and peruse thick metal cell doors and chrome tables in large atriums. The guides say that the design of this prison section was based on US maximum security prisons. They say that conditions were so bad here, with stingy rations and cramped cells, that the prisoners once rioted. Many people died in the riots. But Islas Marias was controversial long before the maximum security section was built. In the early days of the penal colony, political prisoners were sent to the prison island. José Revueltas, an author and Mexican Communist Party member, who was convicted after attending a union strike, was sent there twice in the 1930s. Now, Revueltas is depicted in a large mural in a visitor centre on the island, wearing spectacles and hunched over a book. His 1941 novel, Muros de Agua, Walls of Water, was based on his experience on Islas Marias. Some prisoners were arguably far more deserving of their confinement. The guides take us to the sun-beaten white stone tomb of José Ortiz Muñoz, known as El Sapo, the Toad. Ortiz was sent to Islas Marias after committing various murder sprees and ended up getting murdered himself. The guides tell us that a group of Islas Marias prisoners killed him with machetes. In the latter years of the prison, many convicts lived relatively openly on the island, roaming freely and sometimes having family come and stay with them. It was the ocean, rather than locks and walls, keeping them confined. But many were forced to work under intense sunlight on vast salt flats as punishment for supposed bad behaviour on the island. The guides take us to the salt flat area, right by a beach. From a derelict brick salt storage building, I see a large shark moving among the ocean waves. In 2019, when Mexico's then-president Andrés Manuel López Obrador closed the Islas Marias prison, he suggested that the change marked a break from Mexico's past of political persecution and terrible treatment of convicts. He said, "This is tourism for excursions, to explore, to live with nature. What was hell is becoming a paradise." I wouldn't call Islas Marias a paradise, but parts of it are dramatically pretty, as are the endemic green parrots. Shortly before getting back on the ferry to leave the island, I meet again with Francisco Epinosa, the tourist I spoke to earlier. He says he enjoyed the weekend and learning about aspects of his country's past that he hoped would stay in the past.
Yeah, from the past, from the old governments, the corrupt governments. Today we got better government, things are changing, and that's why they close it for the same reason.
We head to the buffet for one last taco. For The World, I'm Jamie Fullerton on Islas Marias.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the northwest of Morocco, floodwaters that covered more than 400 square miles are beginning to recede. That is good news for the nearly 200,000 people evacuated earlier this month, many of whom were evacuated preemptively as major storms pushed a nearby dam past its limit, forcing the government to release some of the water or risk the whole dam bursting. But what evacuees will find if they return home is an open question. Tiziana Bonzon is the head of the North Africa delegation for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. She told me earlier today the situation is still evolving.
One of the first things that will happen is that local authorities, civil protection, as well as the Red Crescent volunteers from the Moroccan Red Crescent will need to start by assessing structural damage to homes, checking the roads, the electrical system need to be inspected. So people will not be able to go back immediately. And so they will continue to be in the shelters that have been set up for them still for a while until, you know, the conditions allow them to go back. Another major risk is stagnant water. We know that this is going to pose serious health risks, so it's very important that disinfection, pumping, drainage happens, and especially sanitation services are restored. And of course, one of the activities we do as part of, you know, our volunteers do is hygiene promotion, which is essential before people, you know, can return home.
Hygiene promotion, absolutely.
Another thing, of course, that we will be able to do and help communities with is clean and ventilate their houses where it's possible, but also identify hazards that they may not be aware of, like contaminated wells or, you know, unsafe walls. So all of those things will be part of what now. You know, what we already know is that this flooding will have important consequences on livelihoods. And so it's not just the safety of, you know, homes and roads and infrastructure. It's also the fact that people have actually lost crops, livestock, small businesses.
I was going to ask you about that, yes, Tiziana, because much of the region indeed where the floods occurred supported agriculture. So how much
absolutely
of that production was destroyed, and what's been the wider impact of that for the country?
Yeah. Certainly a lot. And we are already, you know, thinking about what are going to be the consequences in the coming months in terms of possible inflation, you know, prices of fruit and vegetables, cereals, milk are going to rise. So it is super, you know, very important for recovery efforts to start already thinking now in terms of restoring livelihoods. And one tool that we are already using is cash. You know, distributing cash is one of the most dignified and effective way of helping families, you know, use it for what they need, whether they need it for, you know, buying tools to repair their homes or medicines or buying food or even, you know, for education to send kids back to school. So cash is going to be very important. But if you allow me, I would just like to say that, you know, recovery is not just about rebuilding structures. It's also helping people get over the trauma. People are now frightened. They lost confidence. And some they even lost it. You know, we have to help them restore the dignity and recover the stability they need.
I was going to ask you, what has been the response from the Moroccan government? Do residents feel like they're getting the assistance they need?
I have to say that the response of the government has been incredible because they've been reacting really fast. First of all, with these preventive evacuations, which was essential. So the past 2 weeks have been pretty much about ensuring, first of all, the families have safe places to stay, looking at the issue of clean water and sanitation to reduce health risks and providing medical care. These have been the most important, I would say, areas of support.
Just to come back to the dam, the Oued Makazine Dam, that had to release water.
Yes.
It's faced challenges in the past couple of years due to very heavy rainfall in Morocco. And it really seems to show how technology has been unable to keep pace with the weather. So as Morocco looks to the future, is there like a national plan to essentially retrofit dams to deal with this intense precipitation?
It's a good question. I'm not sure I'm able to answer that. But what I can say is that I've seen major investments done in Morocco to be much better prepared and aware of the risks that are especially climate-related risks. And I think the dam has been also, they realized that there were some blockages at the bottom of the dam. So sometimes it's also a question of improving maintenance of this type of infrastructure. And And this is certainly something that authorities are now, you know, not just realizing, but will be looking into more in the future. And we have to just acknowledge the fact that these floods and, I mean, the rainfall that has been experienced was quite exceptional in comparison with what, you know, what has been pretty much drought and a scarcity of water in the past few years in Morocco. So definitely not the level of, you know, water that was easy to manage.
Tiziana, it sounds like you've got confidence in the Moroccan government for the road ahead and avoiding future disasters. But what concerns do you still have?
What I think is really important to say is that while, of course, authorities can work on, you know, a national level and provincial level, regional, at community level, you need to have organizations that are able to talk to the communities, that are trusted organizations, that they can understand the needs of the communities and help the communities themselves better understand the risk that they're facing. And it's not going to stop. We know that with climate change, these risks are going to simply be, you know, much stronger. And disasters are going to be more extreme and more frequent. Preparedness is essential, you know, to what will come in the future.
Tiziana Bonzon is the head of the North Africa delegation for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Today marks the second anniversary of the death of Alexei Navalny, the Russian opposition figure who died while serving a prison sentence in a penal colony in the Russian Arctic. This is from a video courtesy of the Associated Press showing a group of mourners laying flowers on Navalny's grave in Moscow. According to Russian authorities, Navalny died of natural causes, but there's long been a belief that he was poisoned. President Joe Biden had this to say 2 years ago.
Russian authorities are going to tell their own story. But make no mistake, Putin is responsible for Navalny's death.
Now those suspicions have been confirmed. European labs analyzed samples taken from Navalny's body and confirmed the presence of epibotidin. That's a neurotoxin secreted by poisonous dart frogs native to Central and South America. These findings were announced by UK Foreign Minister Yvette Cooper in a joint statement with France, Germany, Sweden, and the Netherlands.
Only the Russian government had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to use that toxin against Alexei Navalny in prison. And that is why we are here today, to shine a spotlight on the Kremlin's barbaric attempt to silence Alexei Navalny's voice.
Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya, says she was certain from the first day.
Now, it's not just words, it's scientific proof that my husband, Alexei Navalny, was poisoned and killed by Russian government and by Vladimir Putin.
Navalny had survived a previous poisoning attempt in 2020, which he blamed on the Russian government. 5 months later, he was arrested in Russia and spent the last 3 years of his life in the prison where he died. We'll be back in a minute with the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. We've been keeping track of the aftermath of last fall's elections in Cameroon in Central Africa. Quick refresher on that situation. Paul Biya started his eighth term as president a couple of months ago. He's now the world's oldest ruler. He turned 93 a few days ago. After the election last October, protests erupted with opponents saying the vote had been fraudulent. Authorities responded with lethal force, leaving at least 48 people dead. That's according to both Human Rights Watch and the UN. It is against that backdrop that writer Patrice Ganang has published a memoir of growing up in Cameroon in the 1970s and 80s. It's called Scale Boy. More on that title in a moment. Patrice, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I'd like to start with something you said about what motivated you to write this memoir, the desire to see a different kind of book about life in Africa than what's currently on the shelves. What did you feel was missing?
What I feel is missing is a broad presentation of what it means to be somebody from Africa. I think the story of Africans is essentially summarized in one sentence. He was born a slave and he came to the USA to become free. I always felt it didn't capture the happy childhood I had. So I felt the need to narrate it, you know, my hope being that somebody will read and understand what it essentially means to be me.
Well, Breaking Stereotypes takes us to the title of your book and what seems kind of a curious way to make money for a kid. Scale Boy is a title. It refers to your first job in your Francophone home of Yaoundé, the capital of Cameroon. You were what's called a pèse personne. What does a scale boy do?
Well, you wake up in the morning, you pick up your scale.
Is it like a bathroom scale?
Yeah, something like that. It is essentially a bathroom scale. Most people don't have a bathroom scale. In Cameroon, your weight is something that you essentially do publicly. And everyone sees your number. And, you know, you pay the kid a few cents and that's it.
I mean, you find it kind of humorous now looking back on it, but you start your book by describing an encounter with a scale boy upon returning to Cameroon as an adult yourself. It's an emotional moment for you. Can you describe what happened and why it was so moving?
Yes, it is. The thing is, living Cameroon, I mean, I've been living outside of Cameroon now for 30 years. So it is a coincidence like that. You know, you see essentially the kid that I was walking towards me and you know, walking, doing exactly the same job I had. So it is the moment I essentially felt the kid needs to have a voice and that voice needs to be heard.
So you also share an anecdote about buying your own scale as a kid. Your dad takes you to a store and the owner shows you two scales. One is German, the other is French made. And there's a lot going on in that scene, it seems, not just about the scale and its country of origin, but about the role each country played in colonizing Cameroon. Can you say more about that?
Well, it is a long story because it is a story that ends, you know, with a civil war, you can imagine. A memoir is written backwards. And these are scenes I would not have understood as a child, as a kid. You know, my dad walking into a store, a store that essentially was a remnant of, colonial times. It is a fateful moment for sure. And, thinking backwards, I realized that is really the very first moment when I had something German in my hands. Hoops, you know, and it remained my mind as, something tangible, something that, people actually love to use. But I did not know the story of Germany in Cameroon. I did not know the story of Germany itself. I had to learn all those things in school, of course, and, later on, throughout my life.
Was that the moment where you kind of think you started wanting to learn about that history?
It's a mixture because, my dad was a librarian, you see, so I grew up amongst books, even at home and particularly in his office. Books were always around me. So I would say, the moment when I could connect the books that I was reading with something tangible I had in my hand. So I did not understand that it was colonialism. I did not understand it was post-colonialism. I didn't have those concepts for sure. But it is later on that it made sense to me.
I'm speaking with Cameroonian-American writer Patrice Ngang about his memoir, Scale Boy, and what it can tell us about Cameroon today. So Patrice, Cameroon has a history of not one but several colonizers, France and Great Britain, and up until the end of World War I, Germany, as you were talking about. Today, the country is split between a side that speaks French and another half that speaks English. In terms of religion, the country is divided, 66% Christian, 30% Muslim about. I mean, that's a lot of division. Help us understand how those divides have played into the way President Biya has stayed in power for so long.
Yes, divide and rule. I think it is important to start with the moment when during colonialism, Germany lost World War I. So essentially, Cameroon, as a former German colony, became, a bounty. It was split between the French and the Germans. That German side of Cameroon never disappeared. So it remained in the belly. So I would say Cameroon has three colonies in its belly. As a country, you have three countries in one. And since German colonial years, divide and rule was always the way through which Cameroon was governed. And Biya Kulse stayed so long in power only because of that tactic. So he has essentially always managed to use the French against, the French-speaking Cameroonians against the English-speaking Cameroonians. And as we see, it has made it possible for him to remain in power for so long, but also to have Cameroonians kill each other.
So the most recent election in October, Paul Biya won it with just over 53% of the vote. The opposition claimed fraud. But in many authoritarian states, the incumbent almost always takes a suspiciously large share of the vote, 80 or 90 plus percent. Isn't it possible then with such instability in the nation, Paul Biya could have received 53% fairly?
No, it is certainly impossible. The last time he actually, ran in an election that was fair was 1992, and he lost that election. So since then, all elections in Cameroon are mired in violence and killings. The English-speaking part of Cameroon is actually experiencing genocide, so the burning of houses, the raping of women, etc. So it is, horrific. Essentially, Cameroonians did not go out to vote because they are afraid. They are essentially afraid to be killed. And no one can really, in their right mind accept, the results that came out of that election.
What then do you think the consolidation of power in one man for so long has done to the ability of Cameroon to advance?
The first casualty is the mind. It's the mind of Cameroonians. I think one underestimates what it means to live for so long under a tyranny. Simply the devastation of people's morale, the incapacity to do something tangible, the fear of walking outside, the fear of having, of showing some sense of initiative, is as important as the devastation you see in the country itself, because, the cities are literally left, to the dogs, as one would say. And I'm not even mentioning the killing, that happens in the English-speaking part of Cameroon and of course, in the northern part of Cameroon as well. Mention the fact that writing my memoir, I tapped into a moment when the divide between the North and the South had become violent. And we are back to that, because the North is Islamic, as you mentioned so well at the beginning. And the South is Christian. So in 1984, that's where my memoir stops. There was a coup where, hundreds of Northerners were essentially killed on streets, but also taken to the South and executed. So we are essentially back to that moment of violence where people are simply literally afraid of going outside.
Your book celebrates growing up at a time in your country in the 70s and 80s, but I wonder how you think about young people today in Cameroon, folks who are now the age you were when you were growing up, and what future and opportunities they're facing, remembering that if Paul Biya ends up serving his whole sixth term, he'll be closing in on 100 years old.
Yes, indeed. I can't even imagine it as a possibility. But the thing is, I was sheltered by my parents. I think I had a happy childhood because I had parents who understood that every child deserves to have a childhood. And even though I was growing up, I was a schoolboy walking out and, weighing people outside there, my parents always made sure that when I came back home, that I had an education, that I deserved to have an education, that I had the love that they provided me with. And, they made sure that our home was a loving home. I think for a child of today, that will be the precondition for any sense of, building a future. I don't think that a child that is a casualty of dictatorship will be capable of building a future. And I think it is also the responsibility of the parents to make sure that the kids literally have a childhood as well.
You said you go back to Cameroon. How often do you go back? And I'm wondering what your safety is like there. Do you consider yourself kind of a political dissident?
Well, I was expelled from Cameroon in 2017. You know, that is where my memory stops, essentially. And those scenes are the scenes of before, you know, arriving in Cameroon, meeting people there, my siblings. And it is the last time I saw them. I don't know if I consider myself a dissident. I simply consider myself a person because it will give too much honor, really, to a tyranny to see myself in a position to it. No, no, no. I'm a citizen of the world. I'm a person and I have a name. And in 2017, December, I was expelled from Cameroon.
Did they give you a reason?
Well, I was arrested. I was incarcerated. I was expelled under the most, you know, farcical conditions. But, you know, the regime itself is quite farcical because if you have a regime that with a goal of staying for 100 years in power, you understand that it can only create farce.
I mean, you're chuckling, but I suppose your expulsion is fodder for your writing. Why was it farcical?
One talks today about masked police, and that is the way I was escorted to the airport with masked, you know, police, large guns, and, you know, and I was thrown out of Cameroon. I was deported to the USA. It is the farce of a regime that deports people, and it is the farce of a regime that essentially has masked police people walking around and arresting citizens. That's what I went through in Cameroon. And if I may say, it is quite strange for me to see the same thing happening here in the United States, because the other way around, it is what happened to me in Cameroon. Every regime that does that is essentially farcical.
Yeah, that's a really interesting reflection. So I want to end with a question about becoming a writer, because your own story takes us back to your job as a scale boy, since after walking the streets of Yaoundé, you'd end your shift, as it were, waiting for your father to end his day at the government library, and you would wait in the library. What did that do to change your direction in life, Patrice?
Oh, what it did is it made me take writers themselves seriously, because in the library of my dad used to bind books. So it made it possible for me to see that a book is something that is made. You know, it is tangible. It is made of paper and one works on it. But, you know, essentially, you know, writing is ideas. It is putting oneself out there. Walking around in the city, seeing people, actually judging them, having a value attached to their body is something that the writer does. Because, you know, I take a person and I say that person weight, you know, has this particular value. It has essentially become, you know, my activity as a writer. I would say it is the moment when I confronted the world itself. And I have not stopped writing about Yaoundé, by the way. And it is in that moment, at that age, that I started discovering Yaoundé. And, you know, I'm the writer of Yaoundé and of Cameroon.
Cameroonian-American writer Patrice Ngang's new book, a memoir, is Scale Boy. Patrice, thank you very much. Absolutely lovely to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Once upon a time, and we're talking medieval times now, Arab rulers collected tents. We're talking luxurious distant cousins from your campground variety tent, sleeping bag not included. These tents were intricately designed, made of silk, embroidered with gold, and inlaid with jewels. They were basically portable palaces, symbols of wealth, power, and beauty throughout the Islamic world. As Sarah Birnbaum first reported a year ago, it was odd then to find the image of one in a fresco on the wall of a convent in Ferrara, Italy.
The fresco isn't easy to make out. It's been covered up over the years by pictures of Jesus and the Virgin Mary. But it's there, says Frederica Gigante, a historian at Cambridge University.
So when you come in, you are faced with three alcoves at the back of the church.
At one time, she says, it would have been like you're standing in an elaborate tent with blue and gold silk falling around you.
It really gives the illusion of being a real textile because it's painted with all its folds and fringes, and it's as if it was literally hanging around the three walls.
Along the bottom, there's a border decorated with pseudo-Arabic script. Gigante has a theory about what it's doing there. She believes there was once a real Islamic royal tent hanging here in the church covering the altar. Perhaps it was only brought out on special occasions, and the fresco would have reminded congregants of its splendor. Chagante thinks this tent might have originally belonged to the Muslim ruler of Spain, the Caliph Mohammed el-Nasser, and was seized during the wars between Christians and Muslims for control of the Iberian Peninsula in the 13th century.
It was taken from the Caliph and shipped to the Pope in Rome as a gift.
And then possibly shipped to Ferrara. Even though an Islamic tent in a Benedictine convent might seem weird to us, it wouldn't have to Christians in the Middle Ages. Arab textiles and Arabic scripts were all over the place in churches and in paintings of the Nativity, says Charles Burnett. He's a historian at the University of London.
It is quite common for Arabic inscriptions or pseudo-Arabic on the garments, especially of the Virgin Mary. And you can recognize sometimes verses from the Quran, certainly holy verses, featuring prominently in these inscriptions on the hems.
He says Islamic textile in the minds of Christians at the time was associated with the Holy Land in the time of Christ. There is this misconception that because the Holy Land in the 13th century produced lavish textiles, and people spoke Arabic, and it was ruled by Muslim rulers, the same must have been true in the time of Christ.
Especially in nativity scenes, the Arabic is simply there to invoke the Middle East.
There's another reason, says Frederica Gigante. These textiles are beautiful, really the finest in the world. What better to adorn the Virgin or cover the altar?
Not only textiles, but in general, Islamic art at the time was so much appreciated for its incredible quality. It was a given, and Christians were really ready to incorporate it, even in churches.
It's a good reminder, says Gigante, of cross-cultural exchange. We tend to think of Christians and Muslims in this period as in conflict, and they were. But the reality is far more complicated and interesting. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. These Winter Olympics so far have been something to watch. The 29-year-old cross-country skier from Norway, Johannes Klebo, secured his place in sports history. He won his 9th gold medal on Sunday, making him the most successful Winter Olympian ever. Alpine skier Lucas Pinheiro Braten won a gold, delivering Brazil its first ever medal at the Winter Games. He danced a little samba to celebrate. Pretty cool. The U.S. women's hockey team is another one to keep an eye on. Sarah Spain is reporting on the games from Italy. She's the host of the podcast Good Game with Sarah Spain and joins us today from Cortina. So coming off the weekend, Sarah, what stood out to you as highlights?
Being here in Italy, it's an extra treat to watch Italians find success. And one of the Italian torchbearers was actually someone coming in who had set pretty low expectations for herself, Federica Brignone, because she suffered a leg fracture and a torn ACL just last April. So for a long stretch leading up to the game, she wasn't even sure if she'd be well enough to compete. And she said to her brother, who also works with her, "I just want to be free. I just want to enjoy the games." And she really had set pretty low expectations because of the injury. She told me after her giant slalom race yesterday that she would have been happy just to be the torchbearer, that that would have been enough of an honor and enough of a moment. And instead, she's won 2 golds here in the Super-G and the giant slalom.
Federica Brignone was flanked by not one, but 2 silver medalists, Norway's Thea Steinarsund and Sweden's Sarah Hector. What happened there?
Okay, this is insane. I think this might be the wildest thing I've seen live. So in the giant slalom, they record your time up to 1/100 of a second. You would think that would be enough.
You would think.
And the 2 athletes didn't just tie in the cumulative time of both of their runs put together. That's what happens in giant slalom. You have 2 runs and the time in both is added together to decide your final time and where you fall. And these 2 women, Thea and Sarah, skied the exact same time to 1/100 of a second in their first heat. and the exact same time to a hundredth of a second in their second run.
That's just nuts.
For them to get the exact same time to the hundredth of a second in both was unfathomable. And what was so cool about it is they have a great friendship. They know each other from the tour, and the way they embraced sharing silver, each of them get a silver and then a bronze is not awarded for the event, was so fun to watch. They were sharing this seat that they have. And essentially, if you're in the lead for an event, you sit in the gold medal seat and the camera's fixed on you to see your reaction as people pass you or don't pass you. And they were sitting one cheek each on the seat, sort of snuggling together, trying to share it as they watched. And they had bronze at one point. Okay, we're going to be at least, you know, bronze. Okay, we're going to be silver. It was really fun to watch them just interact and talk about each other after the event, too.
That is just beautiful. Well, here's Norway's Stenersund commenting on that tie with Sarah Hector.
It makes you more grateful about getting it together when it's so close. So it's a gratitude in the medal itself, then.
So freestyle skiing happened yesterday. I want to ask you about Eileen Gu. There was a big spotlight on her during the 2022 Olympics. Young, successful, American-born athlete representing China. How did she do yesterday?
So yesterday she qualified for the finals and she ended up taking second in free ski slope style, which is the one where you are jumping onto rails and then doing tricks, and they do a combination of a number of things to come up with your cumulative score. And she got second once again to Mathilde Grimaud, who took gold. This is a repeat of the last Olympics. It's not Eileen's best event, but she still felt really, really proud of the outcome. And we got a chance to talk to her after that event.
So here's something Eileen Gu told your producer.
My biggest goal has always been to bring the sport to more young people, especially girls. I gave my first speech on Title IX in women's sports when I was 11. And so I've been a pretty consistent person this whole time, which is an interesting thing because now I'm 22 and I've done things that I wouldn't have never imagined possible when I was giving that first speech. And yet, in a lot of ways, also, I'm the same person at my core. So a rising tide raises all boats. And so I'm honored and privileged to have the platform that I do, and I take it with great responsibility.
A speech on Title IX at the age of 11.
Yeah. She is this unique, multifaceted superstar. She makes over $23 million a year in China.
Wow.
So when folks are asking, why compete for China? Right? She says, of course, and I believe this wholeheartedly, it's in part to honor her mother's roots, but it doesn't matter how great you are at these sports. Chloe Kim is not making $23 million in the States, but to be a model, a spokesperson, a gold medalist at the China Games, to step into the moment that she had at that Games and live up to expectation and go beyond. She is now an icon in a way that so few can be, and it pays off big bucks in China.
So Eileen Gu is not the only American playing for another country. One person who stands out among those you spoke to was Sarah Schlepper, born and raised in the U.S., now at the age of 46, much respect, she represents Mexico alongside her son. Tell us more about Sarah Schlepper.
Yeah, she's a fascinating story. She competed for the U.S. for a number of Olympics. This is her seventh Games for the last three, including this one. She's competed for Team Mexico. And she has an interesting insight, of course, on the different resources and support that you get on Team USA versus Team Mexico. But she grew up the daughter of a ski shop owner, and it's in her blood, it's in her veins, and very clearly in her DNA. And she passed it on to her son, who's also competing at these games, which makes them the first ever mother-son duo to compete at the Winter Olympics. And then, unfortunately, in the race that we saw yesterday, the giant slalom, basically she was disqualified because of the distance between the bottom of her ski boot and the snow. And she made an error. The lesson out of that was that she's tuning her own skis. She's acting as her own ski tech here. And when she was with Team USA, there was a whole team of people to help with that sort of thing. She's also tuning her son skis, and he's competing about 6 hours away in Bormio. So she was going to, after her race, hop in with one of her sponsors to make it to Bormio to try to see him today. And her husband has been picking up the slack, helping with the tuning of the son's skis while she's been away.
Your podcast, Sarah, Good Game with Sarah Spain, it's all about women in sports. After a bit more than a week at the Olympics, is there anything that kind of strikes you about the range of female competitors at these games?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the coolest things in women's sports is the camaraderie I mentioned, the athletes supporting it and really bonding on the tour, but also there's a really interesting and cool element of women who are married or dating. Two nights ago, we saw the skeleton competition. Brazil's Nicole Silveira and Belgium's Kim Malemans are married, and they competed against each other in the Olympics on Valentine's Day. They are actually rooming
That's
together
so
here
cool.
at the Games in the Brazilian house. It's very rare. Usually all the athletes from the same country are roomed together, but they've allowed them to share a room. And when they arrived, it was decorated half Team Brazil, half Team Belgium. So sweet. So seeing things like that, seeing Team USA's Hillary Knight, the star of the hockey team, rooting on her girlfriend, Brittany Bow, who's a Team USA speed skater. There's some really cool demonstrations of caring as much as one humanly can about winning while holding at the same time respect and love and desire for other people to find success as well, whether that be because they're your wife or your girlfriend or just because you have a really strong bond with them from competing year over year. You know, when you're not at the Olympics, you might kind of roll your eyes at the idea of the Olympic spirit can like get you through anything. But it does feel like here there's a lot of moments that demonstrate that between countries and competitors.
Women throwing a global winter party in the Italian Alps. Sarah Spain is the host of the podcast Good Game with Sarah Spain. She joined us from Cortina in Italy. Sarah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The World is produced by GVH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Piggott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.